I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You know you've made it big when you're featured on the cover of Time magazine. Well, there is, as far as I know, only one person in this country whose handiwork has appeared not only on the cover of Time, but of Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report and Business Week and Sports Illustrated and National Geographic, and not just once, but every time one of the magazines comes out. His name is Matthew Carter. He is a designer of type. He shapes the letters themselves. He practices a craft that was once considered successful if it was not noticed. But now it's a place where we all play. Every time you turn on a computer and select a font, Times New Roman, Arial, Gothic, you are choosing the artwork of type designers like Matthew Carter. Well, how about Verdana, Snell Roundhand, Helvetica, Galliard, Georgia, Miller? These are all his. Connection listeners, fess up. We all have a favorite font. What's yours and why? But let's go a little deeper this hour. Why do we concern ourselves with fonts and typefaces? And how does the design of the letter itself affect the way we choose to build words and sentences and ideas? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And just a word, you can check out our website. We have a gallery of images from a traveling museum exhibit that is featuring Matthew's work. It's currently at the University of Pennsylvania. If you go to our website at theconnection.org, you'll not only get a chance to see some of that, but find out more about the exhibit itself. Matthew Carter has over 40 years' experience cutting, punching, melting, molding, and designing type. He founded and ran the type company Bitstream. He's now one of the heads of Carter & Cone Type, where he is once again and still designing type. He's here with me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. Is your work still meant to be somewhat invisible? Are we not supposed to pick up a magazine and go, there's Carter's work again?
It depends on the typeface. Largely, I think that is true. For text typefaces, if you are conscious of the typeface, there's probably a problem with it. Display faces are rather different. They don't have to be so easily readable. They can be eye-catching and so on. And, you know, people, I think, are more aware of the characteristics of display faces that, you know, form the headlines in magazines and newspapers and so on than they are with the text. But, yeah, the text faces are largely anonymous, I think.
The first time I started to pay attention to type in books, for example, came, you know, when you're reading a book that you're particularly infatuated with, and so you keep turning the pages even when there's nothing on them, and you get to the end of the book and you read, this book was set in Garamond. The face is dignified and is light but without fragile lines. The italic is modeled after a font, and so on and so
yes.
on like that.
Because some publishers do that. Not all by any means.
I like
means.
It, actually. Yeah. In a way, it sort of takes me back into the book in a way that I hadn't thought about it. When you're actually working, designing, do you see yourself as an artist, as a potter? Are you creating something from a blob, or is there something scientific to it as well?
I don't think of myself as an artist. I don't have a fine art background. I got started working in a type foundry. I learned to make type before I could design it. So no, I don't think of it as being an artistic pursuit. Largely, I think artists, fine artists, work with private images, and type designers are stuck with very public images in the sense that the conventions of the alphabet are so fixed that there's only a certain amount we can do to a letter B before it ceases to be recognizable as a B. So there is that constraint on the thing that we do. Now, whether that is artistic or not, it's really hard to say. I mean, there are type designers who do have a fine art background, and if they were sitting in this chair, they might disagree with me very much. But I personally, I don't think of myself as an artist.
You see yourself as someone who's mixing the oil paints and giving it to someone else to be creative with?
Yes. Yeah, I'm at the raw material stage. I mean, I design typefaces. They go out in the world. If they've been commissioned by a particular magazine, then I know a certain amount about how they're going to be used, obviously. But very many typefaces just go out there into the retail font market, and I have no control, necessarily any knowledge about how they get to be used and what for and so on. I mean, occasionally I will see a book that I recognize the typeface or a CD cover or something or other, you know, but...
Oh, come on. You must pick up a tube of toothpaste and look at the font on it before you start reading it. I can't imagine you'd ever be able to divorce yourself from that.
Oh, yeah, it's surprisingly easy. I mean, I do recognize typefaces of my own and of colleagues and so on, of course, but you know, the professional deformation is not total. I mean, I can read a book without constantly criticizing the lowercase g every time I read it and so on. Yeah.
When you were just a teenager, you were packed up and sent off to the Enschede foundry in Holland. You were working with one of the masters, P.H. Radish. Is that
yes.
how I say his name?
Yes, indeed.
What were you doing at that time?
Well, I had just left school, and I was supposed to go up to Oxford University, but I had a year to fill between an interlude of a year. And my parents, I suppose, not thinking very highly of the idea of having me hanging around the house for a year, had this idea. My dad had good connections with this Enschede company, which was a very fine printer in the Netherlands. And he arranged for me to go there as an unpaid trainee, an intern, for a year. And Enschede, the company still exists. They're a very remarkable, ancient company. And unlike any other printers, I think at that time, commercial printers, they insisted on making their own type, which is a thing that most printers had stopped doing in about 1500 when type founding emerged as a separate trade. But Enschede's were stubborn.
Making your own type means physically carving the letter in
steel? In that case, yes. I mean, this was 1955, and Enschede preferred to do this by very archaic methods. I mean, the same methods, as far as we know, that were used when movable type was invented. I mean, this was a sort of dying craft at the time, an obsolete craft, because type had been mechanized towards the end of the 19th century, the invention of linotype machine, the monotype machine, and so on. But Enschede, as I say, they were stubborn, and they liked to make it by hand methods. So that year I spent working in the type foundry, I tried to do that. And then when I returned to England to start university, I really had a change of heart. I'd gotten interested in this process. And so I got the courage up to say to my parents that I wanted to drop out of university before I'd started, you know. And to my surprise, they were very accepting of this and very encouraging. And so what was supposed to have been an interlude before I got on with the serious business of life and went to university and so on ended up by determining what I've done every day since, really.
It made you a typographer, if I get the word correctly, because typographer needs to know the whole spectrum of...
I think nowadays the term typographer is more often used by a person who designs with type.
Okay.
I mean, you could say a type designer is a subspecies of typographer, if you like. But as I say, I tend to work on the raw material that gets handed off to typographers or graphic designers and so on.
But if the work that you did back then meant that you could spend an entire day working on a lowercase b,
yes,
and then muss it up,
yes,
15 minutes before quitting time and have,
yes,
to chuck the whole thing,
I'd lost a day's work.
Does that still influence the way that you draft a letter? Are you more careful, more meticulous?
It's an interesting question. I suppose the answer is yes, really. I mean, I, for better or worse, I was trained at a time when making a mistake was very costly in time, money, whatever, the big penalty associated with getting something wrong. Nowadays, if you work with a computer, there's virtually no penalty. There's an undo command. You know, if you make a mistake, you back up and go again, you know. So whether you learnt in the way that I did, whereas I say the price of making a mistake was one you wanted to avoid at all cost, or whether you work with computers, as you know, students that I know now do, at the end of the day, there has to be some judgment. I mean, whether you've made one lowercase b in metal or whether you've made 100 of them on a computer, at the end of the day, you've got to decide whether it's right or not. So where does that judgment come from? And I would say that in my case, it came from having to think long and hard and have a very good idea in my mind's eye about what this B looked like before I started it, because if I blew it, you know, I just wasted a day. A student would say, well, you know, I don't have that constraint. I can produce 100 different Bs, all different subtle variations, and that's much better than my traditional method, because a student can afford very little price for making a mistake. You can afford to experiment and try different things and so on. And I think that's a completely valid point. I mean, I'm very open-minded about that. I mean, I learnt the judgment, I think, in the way that that it was presented to me at the time and the technology of the time. But I think that students can learn that equally well in the way I've described nowadays. So I don't think one method is completely wrong and one is completely right.
I mentioned the letter B just by chance, but is there a letter in the alphabet, uppercase, lowercase, Roman, italic, where you start when you're working with new type? Is there one that you consider kind of the central or building block?
Yeah, I think there's a small subset of the alphabet that I would concentrate on first, and I'm sure every type designer has different favorite letters as a way of getting into the thing in the first place. I generally start with the lowercase H and O because those two letters embody an awful lot of information. They're very simple letters, but, you know, an H has essentially straight sides and an O is round and so on. I might then make a P because it's half straight and half round. It sort of check out the decisions I've made with the H and the O. So we tend to work very intensively on a small number of letters, and they're sort of like DNA. I mean, you can there's an awful lot of information in that small number of letters, which you can then extrapolate and build. I mean, if you've done an H, there's a lot of clues about how the lowercase n is going to be in the M and the U and so on. Mm-hmm. Those forms are related. So, yeah, I tend to start with those letters and build on those gradually.
I was actually struck looking at the museum catalog of your work how much work goes into designing a type, because it hadn't occurred to me. Not only do you have to do all the uppercase letters and all the lowercase letters, but you have to do them now in bold and italic and yes. Roman, and then, of course, all the punctuation that goes yes. alongside. It ends up being, what, over 200
indeed,
different images.
Indeed, the computer font is much more than caps, lowercase, figures, and points. I mean, there are accents in there, monetary signs, math symbols, and so on, all of which have to be designed every time.
At Carter and Cohn, can you do the sort of Rodin thing and say, look, I've done the H and the O and the P. You underlings go and fill in all the other letters?
No. I work by myself, and I really like doing the whole thing myself. But there again, you know, it's impossible to generalize about type designers. There isn't a generality of us, and I have many colleagues who do exactly what you describe. I mean, they're more like architects. They run an office, and they've done what they think are the critical letters, and sure, they hand it off to someone else to do the accents or something or other. But I prefer to do the whole thing. I learn from doing the whole thing, I think.
We're going to have to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking about fonts, which is where we all play with these. And I just wanted to check with you before we do that, my glossary. Is a font the same thing as a type or a typeface?
Strictly speaking, no, although the terms are increasingly used interchangeably, particularly in the computer world. A typeface is really the design entity, and you can make different fonts. In other words, a font is a manufactured version of a typeface. So you can have a font for a Mac, you can have a font for a PC, a PostScript font, a TrueType font, have a well-made font, a badly made font, all of the same typeface. So strictly speaking, if you wanted to be pedantic, there is a difference. And, you know,
But if we talk about Verdana, it's a type. It's not a font. A font is what we make with the Verdana.
No, I mean, if you're looking at Verdana on the screen, you are looking at a font of Verdana.
Okay.
It's displaying on the screen because it's a font. It's in a technical form, in a technical format that works on the screen. But way back when I designed Verdana, it's a type design. And as I say, you could have different fonts of it.
Connection listeners, do you have a favorite? If so, why? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Matthew Carter is my guest. You're not going to get a chance to speak to anyone who knows more about that little pull-down menu on your computer or the type in the book or the newspaper or the magazine that you favor. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and today we're talking with Matthew Carter. You can see his work in the redesigned Business Week magazine this month, and also in an exhibit called Typographically Speaking, The Art of Matthew Carter. It's currently showing at the University of Pennsylvania. You can get a look at some of the images from that exhibit on our website at theconnection.org. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. We welcome your calls in our conversation. I want to pick up where we left off, if we can, Matthew, about the image of the letter on the computer screen. because I can't help but wonder whether or not you think that has the same value as the letter once it's been properly inked and pressed onto a nice piece of paper.
Well, at one time, of course, all type was designed for printing on paper. And when screen fonts were first produced, they were adaptations of printing types, I mean, obviously. But then back in the mid-90s, Microsoft sort of faced up to the fact that more and more people, of course, spend their whole lives reading on screen and only occasionally, or perhaps never, dump stuff out on paper. So the conventional priorities that the paper was the real criterion of how a typeface looked was less and less true, I suppose, because more and more people read on screen. And so I got involved in this project with Microsoft where we said we'll reverse the priorities. We'll look at what happens to type on the screen, where the problem is really lack of resolution. There isn't a lot of detail on a computer screen relative to what you get out of even an ordinary office laser printer mm-hmm. nowadays. So we started in that manner, working on the screen, trying the bitmaps, as they're called, the little representations of letters, necessarily rather crude on the screen, at least at text sizes. They tend to be rather crude and generic and so on, and doing the best we could with them, and then sort of backforming. I mean, every typeface has to have a printer version, of course, but that was secondary in the case of Verdana and Georgia and one or two other faces that
but
we did at
those
Microsoft.
Those two, which are yours,
yes.
Which are seen so often now on the screen, when you were fine-tuning those, then you were looking at them on a monitor. You weren't looking at them printed out. This was...
Well, I suppose both, but I mean the priority was how they looked on the screen. These were screen fonts. That was Microsoft was going to bundle them with their apps and give them away because they thought that that this would improve the legibility of type on the screen, and this was to their advantage as developers of software and so on. And so that was the whole philosophy of that project, to make everything as good as it could possibly be on the screen, acknowledging that the screen is very inhospitable in a way to type because it just doesn't have the amount of detail. I mean, the number of dots to the inch on a screen is less than 100, but on an ordinary laser printer, it's at least 600 or 1,200. I mean, my printer at home is 1,200 dots to the inch, which is order of magnitude difference. So in designing Verdana and Georgia, we, as I say, we had to sort of grasp the nettle and say, you know, we haven't got an ideal amount of information for doing this, but we've got to figure it out. I guess it's like the difference between doing an oil painting and a mosaic. You know, if you have doing an oil painting, you have any choice of colors, any size of brush, any size of canvas, whatever you like. But if you're making a mosaic, you have limited number of tiles of a certain size, limited colors, and yet you've got to try and move these little tiles around so they represent
what you need. It becomes more like problem solving.
It is. It really is. I mean, I would say that particular project, Verdana and Georgia, were really problem-solving exercise, the problem being essentially the inhospitable resolution of computer screens.
So does that mean that on-screen fonts like those then perhaps might not have the same artistic personality that something like Miller that you would sit and design on your own time for your own sort of professional pleasure?
It's hard to say. I mean, we certainly tried in developing Verdana and Georgia to give them some inherent visual interest because, of course, they will be used at large size where you can see the details and they will be printed out. I see printed versions of Verdana and Georgia quite often. So I hope they do have some visual quality. They're not totally generic, totally vanilla, you know, but the way most people see them at text sizes on the screen, that is essentially what they are, I suppose.
But do you set out to give a personality to a font, to a type? Is that part of the subjective checklist that you go through?
I suppose so, yes. As I said earlier, I mean, the type designers work within obvious constraints, principally the conventions of the alphabet. You can't distort the letters of the alphabet without breaking a sort of pact with the reader that this form of B has to be recognized subliminally and so on. But at the same time, I suppose all designers are arrogant to a degree and we wouldn't do what we do unless we thought we could find some part of ourselves in a new typeface design, however limited that is. So personality, yes, you try to make distinctions between typefaces by giving them some sort of characteristics, some sort of personality that may derive from your own style, your own way of drawing letters and so on. It may be something that you mentioned Miller, which is essentially a revival of a historical face, early 19th century face. So I hope that it may have some of the qualities that the original did and so on.
But you do know, I'm sure you've been told, how people attach their own personality to their font, how someone will sit down at a computer and they simply can't write anything until they get Galliard or Garamond up, because that's the way they express themselves.
That's true, and of course that's, for me, a very recent thing. That's only come about thanks to computers. I mean, back in the days of typewriters, I don't think most people knew. I mean, the typefaces on typewriters had names, but most people didn't know those, and there wasn't much choice in the matter. But now, all computers come with resident fonts, and a lot of software come with fonts. You know, I was chatting to your producer, who told me that he started using Verdana when he was a grad student and still uses, and he said, you know, it's my typeface. And I said, well, it's sort of mine too. You know, I designed it. Certainly Microsoft's, because they own it. But that's not, and you know, Carlotta doesn't have any typographic training, I don't think. He was at the Kennedy School and so on. But that's not now unheard of for people in completely different walks of life to you get into conversation with some friendly stranger in the next seat on an airplane or something or other, and when they insist on knowing what you do for a living, you say you work with fonts. They very often do know the names of some fonts.
Or they'll say, I do too.
Rarely. That's never actually happened to me yet. I mean, it may do one day. But, you know, in the past, I rather dreaded that moment, because trying to explain to someone what a type designer did was really uphill work. But now if I say I work with fonts, the majority of people at least know what a font is. They may not realize that there is someone responsible for designing and making it. That may astonish them. You know, they think that fonts sort of come out of the software ether and without human agency at all, you know, but so they may be completely baffled by the idea that this is what I do for a living, but at least we've got some common ground, because they know what a font is and they see them on their computer and like color, they know the names of some of them.
1-800-423-8255. That's our number. Let's go first to Newton, Massachusetts, and Alejandro's joining us. Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm fine, thanks.
Fantastic conversation this afternoon. I was a poetry major in college, and so each semester when we put together our portfolio of different poems, I would sit there and pick out different fonts for each poem. When you go to the poetry section in a bookstore, books tend to just have the same font throughout the entire book. But for me, the type of font for each poem is very important.
Alejandro, I can understand the difference between doing something in a soft sort of italic form versus something in a really bold form. But I think you're talking about even more subtle differences than that.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, not just bold or italic, but, you know, Bookman Old Style is my favorite font. I like, I guess the old style, it's in the name. But then you have Helvetica and all the ones that I can't even remember the names of, but they give a different weight, a character, emotion that I feel helps me relate to the reader the mind frame of which the poem is speaking. And I just find this conversation very fascinating, because I was putting together all my poems from college, so I was going through with all the different type fonts, and it's important, I think.
Matthew, is it part of your own design that you'll say, there, I've created... Well, Alejandro mentioned Helvetica. That's yours, isn't it?
Not strictly speaking, no. I did a version of Helvetica, but it's a very interesting question, and I think that in some ways I'm too close to it to have the kind of reaction that Alejandro has to this. He's really making subjective emotional judgments about different typefaces, which is entirely appropriate. But, I mean, that comes from his background, his reading, how he reads this particular poem. But it's very interesting. And as he says, you know, if you go into a bookstore and buy a book of poetry, you are stuck with the typeface. And this is, you know, this is It's not like, I don't know, you know, there are people who have very highly developed visual sense about, mm-hmm. I know, the clothes they wear or the car they drive or the furniture they live with and so on. But they can't express that in typographic terms. If you walk into a bookstore and you pick up a book of poetry and you flip it open and you see it set in Times Roman, you can't go up to the desk and say, does this come in Baskerville? You know, I'm in a Baskerville mood. Or do you have it in Palatino or Bodoni? I mean, they'll think you're a lunatic. You
Although
know?
We can do that on the computer
you
now.
You can. That's exactly my point, that now if you're looking at a document on the computer and you've got it in Verdana and you get bored with Verdana, pull down the menu, change it to Georgia or something else. So that that is something which is relatively new to typography. But so, the, you know, the point that's being made here, I think, is that there are subjective associations that people have with typefaces.
There's one thing that one bit of common ground that you share with Alejandro that interests me in the work that you do, and that's the use of the blank space, because designing the letter it ends up being only a not a small part, but designing the space that separates the letter
yes.
is important as well. And I never thought of that.
It's very important. I mean, there's this paradox about type design. In an immediate sense, we design letter forms, obviously. But that is not really the product of what we do. The product is word shapes, because when we read, our eye jumps down the line and it grabs the word shapes. It doesn't parse each word letter by letter, unless it's a very unfamiliar word or a phone number where you have to spell it out mm-hmm. one digit at a time. So how the letters combine into words is really the point of what we do. And it's how type design differs from various forms of lettering. I mean, if you're a calligrapher or you're cutting an inscription in stone, you know what the words are before you start. You know the order of letters and so on. Type designer does not know that. You don't know what language is going to be used, the typeface is going to be used in. So essentially the characters you do that go into the font have to be randomly combinable. And in order that they combine correctly, the space between them is every bit as important as the positive forms of the letters themselves. In fact, you might even say it's more important. I mean, it's easy to think of type as being black marks on a white background on paper, but in a sense, it's a real sense. It may sound as I'm sort of being paradoxical, but I really think of type as being white space separated by black marks, because the white space is so important to the readability of it. And when I was working on Verdana, I would have conversations with the engineers at Microsoft, and we would put up two versions of a font we were working on, and one would appear to be more readable than the other. But then when they looked closely at the screen, they would say, you know, the bitmaps, the letter forms are really the same or very nearly the same. So why is one more readable? And I would say, well, the spacing is better in this one than that. And that was hard for them to see.
It jumped out and caught my attention because I'm intrigued by the fact that the same thing happens in speech. If I stop, the pause on the radio ends up being more dramatic than anything that I
said. Absolutely. Type designers are not alone in being people who have to be very much concerned with what is not there as much. I mean, architects and sculptors, drummers, I can think of lots of people. I mean, if you say an architect builds a room, actually they don't. They build four walls and a floor and a ceiling. The room is what they don't build. And it's rather like that for a type designer. I mean, we have to be very conscious of all these figure ground games that go on.
Let me go back to our lines if we can. Sure. Alejandro, thanks for your call. We're next to Wellesley, Massachusetts, and David's joining us. Hi, David.
Hello. You were talking before about people having favorite fonts that they like to work in.
Yeah.
It's also possible to have a nostalgic attachment to a typeface from the past. And I'm remembering especially Souvenir, which was absolutely pervasive during the 1970s, during my youth.
I don't know it. Can you describe it in a way that I'll understand what it looks like?
The letters are a little curvy, and they even resemble Hebrew a little bit.
Why are you attached to it?
Well, it is the typeface of my young buck years. And in those days, everything was set in Souvenir. And I'm telling you, you rarely see it now, but if they put anything in that typeface now, you would immediately see sideburns and bell bottoms.
Oh, this is the Sergeant Pepper typeface, or some version thereof, right?
Something like that, yes.
It's perfectly true. I mean, typefaces have fashions like many other things, and Souvenir, I I remember it very well. It came out in the early 70s, and it was a sort of reaction against Helvetica, I think. Helvetica was sort of very clean and almost sanitary in its design, very corporate. And Souvenir was very soft and friendly-looking by contrast, and it had an enormous success. But as the caller says, I mean, it's virtually vanished, and now it does have nostalgic associations for a lot of people, I think. And I think a lot of people have this, that, you know, they had a favorite book in a typeface, or they have some association, some subjective association with a typeface that has come to mean a lot for them.
David, are you still there?
Yes.
Do you use Souvenir now?
You know, I haven't even looked to see if it's available on my computer.
You might have to buy it, license it, but it's certainly available as a computer font. Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
May not have come bundled with the system.
No, it may not come for free.
Well, so do you have one that you choose now, David, or do you pay attention anymore?
Oh, I'm so used to using electric typewriters, IBM Selectrics, that I always look for the face that looks most like that, and that would be Courier.
Which again, is Matthew, an attachment to something that's familiar, right?
Yes. I mean, Courier was one of the most used typewriter typefaces going way back. And again, that's freely available on computers as well, and a lot of people choose to use it. It has one characteristic which is sometimes useful. You know, typewriters, every character in the font had to have the same width, which is a very uncomfortable thing for typefaces, but some of them, like Courier, were really designed with that in mind, and sometimes it's necessary
nowadays.
Does that
mean the I had
big
that. Feet,
yes,
so it looked
yes,
like the
and
M?
The W was very cramped and
okay.
so on. Yeah. And Courier has that characteristic, and sometimes that's useful. Sometimes people need a fixed pitch font to use in certain circumstances, and so Courier is widely available, largely for that purpose. But again, it reminds an awful lot of people of a previous time when they were familiar with the typewriter output.
And it's a place where you go as a designer. You go back to things that are familiar, but maybe back to the 15th or the 16th century for type to work with. But it's a nice, it gives you something to start with, something
yes.
to work with. 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, my guest is Matthew Carter. If you have a piece of paper anywhere on the table or the dashboard near you, chances are some of his work is on that paper in the design of the font or the typeface that you or we so often take so much for granted. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Carrie Jacobs, in her piece, An Existential Guide to Type, writes this. She says, a typeface is rhythm, the beat of the written language, the stride of letters marching across the page. With me in the studio, Matthew Carter, one of the world's premier designers of typeface, or fonts, as we tend to refer to them today. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Bluffton, South Carolina now, and Mitchell is joining us. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for calling.
This is a pleasure hearing a program like this, because I've spent so much of my life with typefaces. And
are you a typesetter, Mitchell?
No, well, I'll give it to you in two senses. I grew up with a father who was a sign painter. And then after graduating engineering school, I went to work with Mergenthaler Linotype, where we developed the first photo comp machine, you know, for cold type. And working with Jackson Burke at that time, having control over the looks of typefaces when they went from hot to cold type. It was just a fascinating education which has stayed with me all my life.
You're going to have to explain that for me, Mitchell. I'm a bit of a Luddite here. When you say going from hot to cold type, what do you mean?
Oh, well, type was set with molten metal. You know,
right.
With
so that's the hot lead.
Hot lead,
yeah.
Right. And in any one given line, when it's set, there are you might have hundreds of A's, hundreds of B's, hundreds of C's, but everyone was a different actual, what was called a slug or a matrix. And so that when you type became worn, you looked at the typeface, people didn't really see it, but type got old, got a nice look to it, a feel to it. It got chipped, it got worn to a certain extent. So what happened was I used to examine type this way, and I used to look down a baseline, which means you hold the type line on its edge, and you'll see a high A, a low A, and what I'm talking about is high or low relative to what's called the baseline. And so it gives a line a character where no line looks like any other line. So I was going to try to, which I did in a way, incorporate it in the software design, because we were developing the first software for that, actually, my wife and I. And
were you able to reproduce that at all, Mitchell?
Yeah, slightly, yeah, because I could adjust. See, and any time I wanted to put out a letter, I could send out codes, which we developed, which became like a hypertext protocol language, to adjust the baseline, where that actual figure was going to be positioned in the code type system. But they figured it was just too much work, and no one really appreciated it after we ran a lot of tests.
Except maybe someone like Matthew Carter was following
well,
along.
The reason was you always had the exact same A with code type, just like you have the only one A on the computer, okay, in a given font.
Right.
So no matter what you do to that A, you can't make one A nicked and a little high and another one worn and whatnot. So it lost its purpose, but I was trying to do it.
Mitchell, turn to Matthew, because you've had experience at both ends.
Yeah, you know, Mitchell and I, we must have just missed one another. I went to work at Mergenthaler Linotype in 65, just after Jackson Burke had retired, who Mitchell mentioned. And yeah, this is a very interesting point. In moving technologies, changing technologies from hot metal to film and then to digital type and then to the desktop and then the web and so on, what is lost and what is gained along the way? And I think Mitchell feels there have been losses that computer type or photo type had a sort of coldness, a lack of variability that existed in hot metal, not deliberately, but just because of the nature of the technology, you tended to get these minor variations and so on that he's talking about, of alignment and so on, which, you know, unless your photocomposing machine is badly out of adjustment, you cease to get. And, you know, I'm not unsympathetic to that, but all I can say is that having worked with all of these technologies in turn, I have no regrets about the current digital technology. I mean, if I had any choice in the matter, I would unhesitatingly choose that technology. Have there been some losses? Maybe, and maybe Mitchell's put his finger on a good example. Have there been some gains for me? Yes, and they hugely outweigh the losses, I must say.
But one of the downsides is that in one sense, instead of it being this privileged place that the type designer occupies. I mean, really, the barbarians are at the gates now. Everybody is doing this.
Yes.
And
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But you're not saying that that's necessarily cheapened either the art or the product.
No, I don't believe so. I mean, when the personal computer came along and what had been a very abstruse business when I got into it, a very difficult business to get into for obvious reasons, became much more accessible to anyone who had a Mac and Fontographer and so on. They could make a typeface. A huge amount of experimental work was done. I mean, some of it was very bad and died a death, fell by the wayside and so on, but some of it has endured. And I think, you know, again, many people would disagree with me, but I think the trade-off was to everyone's benefit. I mean, yes, the barbarians came through the gates. You know, when in my early life, I was sort of part of a priesthood, you would say, of initiates, you know, and there weren't very many of us who even knew what a typeface was, let alone how to design it. Now there are an awful lot of people who have that knowledge and use it very well, and I'm all for that. I mean, I think the benefits outweigh the downside. But you know, there are what are known as dinosaurs who regret very much the passing of the old technologies and so on. And you know, I can see that as well. But for me, it's a balancing act.
All right, Mitchell, thank you very much for your call. Now to Cohasset, Massachusetts, and Sam's with us. Hi, Sam.
Hi, this is Sam. How are you?
I'm fine. What do you think?
Well, listen, I mean, you tied right into the issue of technology beautifully there. My question for Matthew is this. Do you think that graphic design and document design has suffered on some level, because it is now so easy for laymen to design documents. And they say things like, I designed it myself, which is just runs cold through your blood when you hear that. And you see these resumes that look like, for example, like ransom notes, where people have gone through and inserted, inserted
every line in a different typeface. Yes, yeah.
You know, well, it's
I think I know where you are on this one.
Well, exactly. Obviously, I'm betraying my bias here, but basically, people now have the ability, the technology, to be designers, but they have no idea how to do so. And so, my question to you is: what do you think needs to happen, either among application developers, like Microsoft or Quark or whomever, or in education at large? Is there any sort of visual standard? How would such a standard emerge? Is it people like Edward Tufte, sort of saying he has the visual Strunk and White in his book, saying this is how documents should look and be designed? Or is it really just going to, is everybody just going to continue stuffing more and more and more typographical elements onto a page?
Great question. Okay, Matthew.
I know what you mean, Sam. Any time you democratize something which was a sort of closely held business at one time, for better or worse, you're bound to get bad results to an extent. And I know exactly what you mean by these ransom note-like documents and so on that people produce. But I'm still, I don't think I'm quite in the same place that you are about this. I think I have a view that, yes, you get a lot of garbage in situations like that, but you may also get a very fresh look at something which has been in the past rather inhibited and so on. And some of that freshness may rub off on the profession. I mean, innocent users of type sometimes will find things to do that wouldn't occur to us that have had, wonderful trainings in this and know what to do and not to do.
I hear you describing this like a musician would, like a jazz musician will say, I don't listen to rock, but we need to have rock because it's going to make, it'll push us all ahead or in different directions.
Yes. It's a little bit like Mitchell's previous question. I mean, I think there are losses. I think that putting tools in the hands of people who are unwilling to learn to use them properly has certain dangers. But I also think it has some advantages. And I'm not quite as hard on all of this as Sam tends to be.
All right, Sam, thanks for the call. To Merrimack, Massachusetts. And Lance is with us. Hi, Lance.
Hello. Hello, Matthew.
Hi, Lance.
Should we know you?
This is Lance Eide. Yeah, I am a longtime fan of Matthew and his work, and also of his father, Harry Carter. I have a book called A View of Early Typography, which Matthew's father wrote, which is one of my favorite books. And I'd love to hear Matthew say a little bit about the influence of his father on his career.
Well, my dad was a typographer, both a not so much a type designer, but a practical typographer. He designed books and so on. But the latter part of his life, he was a historian of typography. And the book that Lance mentions is one that he wrote when he was working at the University Press at Oxford, where really he was a scholar, no longer a practical designer. And I suppose, obviously, he did have an influence on me. I grew up in that world. I knew the books. I knew the people and so on. He did not push me at all to follow in his footsteps. In fact, I think he rather fancied the idea of me doing something different because, conversation at the dinner table would be more interesting if I did something different. But then, as I described right at the beginning of this conversation, I had this year to kill, and that really sealed my fate working in the type foundry. And then, when my dad saw that I was interested in it, he was extremely encouraging and introduced me to people and so on. So I think I owe him a lot. And I think there's something else. My parents and their friends, I think, were really, in a way, influenced by, at some remoteness, by the British arts and crafts movement, the ideas of John Ruskin and William Morris and so on, in the form that they believed that in order to design something, you really needed to know how to make it. I mean, it would have been inconceivable to my parents that someone should be able to design a table, a dining room table, say, without actually being able to make it themselves. If it was a wooden table, you'd have to know how to use a saw and a plane and chisel and so make the right joints. If you just drew a table on a piece of paper and gave it to someone else and say, hey, make this, it might look all right, but it probably wouldn't work. You know, you put the Thanksgiving turkey on it, it collapses or something rather, because you didn't get the joints right. And I think that attitude that designing and making are not exactly the same thing, but they're almost inseparable, is something that I got on a gene from my parents. I mean, that's very much part of my temperament. And so I think I did, I was influenced in that way by my parents and their friends and others who had this kind of general attitude towards design.
Talking about parental influence, I read somewhere that your mother actually cut out letters in old linoleum as a way of getting you to start read. I don't know what that means. We'd add that onto the pile of influence too, no?
Yeah, it certainly did, because I can remember some of the forms. Yeah, I was 2 years old when the Second World War broke out, and we were evacuated, billeted with various families in the country. My dad was off at the war, of course. And so, you know, toys and games and so on had to be pretty much improvised. And my mother did cut out of, it was lino or something like that, an alphabet of capital letters about, I don't know, 3 inches high, to teach me to read, of course. And I do remember those. I can remember what they looked like, some of them. So they obviously made an impression on me at that time. Yeah.
So whether it's a telephone directory or an elaborate museum catalog, do you put the same care and attention into it? Does it matter as much, or do you say, it's a phone directory, who cares?
Oh, no, on the contrary. If anything, the harder the problem, the more you have to put into it. I mean, the phone Bell Centennial, the phone book face, was a perfect case in point. I mean, you know, the phone books are printed in tiny type on low-grade paper, high-speed presses, and they're all thrown away at the end of a few months anyway, and so on. But those problems, that sort of inhospitable environment for type and for legibility, makes it even more challenging, I think. And if you have, I mean, there are many type designers who would be far too impatient to work on something like that. They would like to work on something that they would say is more creative and so on. But maybe because my background was in a type foundry, I'm always fascinated and challenged by those kinds of problems. And very often, as with working on the screen fonts with Microsoft, there is no absolutely right ideal answer. The question is, which is the least bad choice of letter forms that you're looking at?
Matthew, thank you so much for coming in.
You're welcome. We had some very good questions.
We did indeed.
Yeah.
We always do.
Yeah.
Thanks to the Connection listeners who called in. Matthew Carter, preeminent typeface designer. To continue the conversation or view a gallery of Matthew's fonts, or for more information about the traveling exhibition of his work, check out our website at theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You win.